Today is August 18th, year 2000. This is an abbreviated interview with Commissioner Robert A. Coleman. The interview takes place in City Hall, Paducah, Kentucky. And the interviewer is Betsy Brinson. Thank you, Mr. Coleman, for agreeing to talk with me today. Could you give me your full name, please, so I can get a voice level?
My name is Robert A. Coleman.
Okay. And does the A stand for?
Alfonso.
Alfonso. Okay, thank you. I was asking you about the A in your name. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes, I became curious and I wondered why I had the name Alfonso, because as a small child it was odd. I preferred names like John, Joe, and common names. Mm-hmm. And I asked about the name Alfonso, and my parents told me that when I was born in 1932, either somewhere around that date, the King of Spain was Alfonso. Mm-hmm. And they decided to give me that name. I don't know whether they intend to lift my character or encourage my achievement level, but my father was a graduate of Lane College in Jackson, Tennessee, and my mother attended West Kentucky Industrial College here in Paducah, and I don't know exactly how that came about. Mm-hmm. But
I notice from your biographical statement, though, that you have a son named Dominic and a
right.
grandson, D'Angelo.
Right.
Does the family carry on Spanish names?
I picked some names for my son, and his mother selected that, Dominic. Now, D'Angelo had nothing to do with that.
Right. You're the grandfather
right.
there. So.
I said, what's his name? And they told me. Fine.
Okay.
Okay with me. They
okay.
call him DJ. I like that.
Yeah, I like that. Okay. Well, thank you for that story. Thank you also for agreeing to talk with me. I know this has been rather difficult to get this interview together, and if we don't finish today, I'll be back in Paducah at some point, and we can pick up there. But you mentioned to me that you were born in 1932.
Yes.
Could you give me your complete birth date and also where you were born?
I was born on February the 8th in 1932 in Hopkinsville, Kentucky.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about your growing up. Who was in your family?
My father was from Hopkinsville, Kentucky. My grandparents had roots in Hopkinsville in Christian County, Kentucky. As a matter of fact, my grandfather owned land in Christian County only 30 years after slavery. He bought land in Todd County, which is adjacent to Christian County. And so that's where I was born. My mother was from Paducah, McCracken County, but she went to, when she married my father, she moved to Christian County. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was born.
Okay.
I have two brothers. One is deceased. He was a school administrator in Gary, Indiana. And I used to talk with him about his classroom work and the school system in Gary. And one of the interesting things he told me is he taught some of Michael Jackson siblings. I don't know whether he taught Michael or not, but they are from Gary, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the interesting things about it. He subsequently became a school administrator, but he had a birth defect that defected his bones, and he prematurely died at the age of 48 back in 1982.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have another brother whose name is George. George was one of the first two African-American police officers hired in the city of Paducah, Kentucky. He and a gentleman named Edgar Stratton were hired at the same time back in, I believe, 1962 or 3. And George subsequently became the first director when we set up the 9/11 emergency system here in Paducah, Kentucky. And my mother and father divorced. So I had four other siblings who were all girls. They were born here in Paducah mm-hmm. after my mother remarried. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And of the three brothers, where were you? Were you the
number
youngest?
Number one. I'm number one.
You're
out
the oldest
group
of
them seven.
All. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So you grew up in Paducah?
Yes, I grew up in Paducah. Okay. Attended school in Paducah. Graduated from high school. When I graduated from high school, less than 30 days following my graduation, they had a war to break out. They didn't call it a formal war. They called it a conflict in Korea. Mm-hmm. When the North Koreans crossed what was called the 38th parallel into South Korea, termed as aggression, and we entered into that war. I call it war because men fought and died. Mm-hmm. And so I was draft age at that time. And there was segregation at that time. We had a junior college here, but I couldn't attend that junior college because of the segregation here in across the state, across the country, as a matter of fact, 1950.
Now let me ask you, you graduated from high school in
1950.
1950, mm-hmm. and of course, the legal challenge to Paducah Junior College was in process, as I recall, but it took till about 1953 before the federal court.
It actually, I believe, it may have been longer than extended beyond 53. I'm not certain. I don't have those facts in front of me. But I do know that at the time of my graduation, I was unable to attend. And I lived here in Paducah and could have walked to Paducah Junior College. And so I elected to go into the United States Air Force. I was going to be drafted into the military anyway. Mm-hmm. And I decided to go into the Air Force because I could pick my own choice if I volunteered. After returning from the Air Force in the mid-50s, I subsequently went to Paducah Junior College. By that time, the legal process had cleared the way. Mm-hmm. And in the mid-50s, in the late 50s, I went to Paducah Junior College before it became part of the community college system.
Let me stop you and go back and ask a few questions here. At the point that you enrolled in the junior college, tell me what you planned to study, and also how many other African Americans were attending at that point, just an estimate.
Well, at that time, I enrolled in evening classes. The reason I enrolled in evening classes, I spent 4 years in the military beginning October 1950. Upon returning to Paducah in October 54, within 6 months after I returned, my mother passed away. Mm-hmm. I was the oldest of seven children. I had a brother who was going into his first year in college at Kentucky State. And that was the one who passed away prematurely. He was handicapped. And I had four sisters who were still in secondary school, mm-hmm. secondary school system. So I looked at the economic situation, and I felt it necessary that I hold down a job to help my siblings and my family. I grew up with a sense of responsibility. So I enrolled, but I went to evening classes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I studied basically liberal arts courses because I wasn't really focused on what I was going to do. Some business courses I studied, but at that period in time I did not sense a clear direction as to what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And at the time that you were there, how was the African American enrollment?
Statistically, at the age 23, you're not sensitive to the point where you, especially when you're going in the evening. Mm-hmm. I did not have a sense of how many. I know there were several African Americans enrolled. I do say this, that everything seemed to be running smoothly. I did not encounter any hostilities. Mm-hmm. The teachers were very cordial, and I enjoyed school.
And Paducah Junior College is now Paducah
Community College.
Right, okay.
It's part of the University of Kentucky Community College system now.
Well, it's part of the Kentucky Community College system.
Kentucky Community College system, yes.
Separated from the University of Kentucky a year or so ago.
Absolutely correct.
Okay. You said that you were working during the day and going to school in the evening.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Yes, I went to work. I had a cousin. I said had a cousin because he's since deceased. As a matter of fact, he eventually became administrative assistant to Governor Edward T. Breathitt. Mm-hmm. And he, at that time, he was working for the Illinois Central Railroad System, which was the largest employer in the area. And realizing that I needed a job, he helped me get a job with the railroad system. And I went to work for the railroad system. It was my first employment following discharge from the military.
What were your responsibilities then?
At that time, it was a transitional time for the railroads. They were moving from steam locomotives to diesel locomotives. Mm-hmm. The Paducah shops had been the Illinois Central Systems facility where they built and repaired steam locomotives. What happened is, in this transitional period, they brought the steam locomotives from various areas to Paducah, and we had a facility on the railroad, at the railroad shops, where we literally dismantled these steam locomotive engines. They were huge monsters weighing tons. Mm-hmm. They had all kinds of metal in them, and copper and brass and all kinds of iron, because they had steam boilers, and some of the wheels were 4 feet high, 5 feet high, the driving wheels that carry these locomotives. And so they were huge giants of monsters. Iron monsters is what they literally were. And our basic method for dismantling these locomotives was an acetylene torch that had enough heat in it to burn through perhaps 8 inches of steel. Of course, that's with the skill of knowing how to use these torches. Mm-hmm. And by them being, the locomotives being basically metal, the acetylene torch was the primary method for cutting this metal up, dismantling them. One of the things I noticed around the boiler of these steam locomotives, they were coal fired, it was a round cylinder, if you can visualize the steam locomotives, and it had a sheet of metal around it, like a huge tube, and that was the boiler. But underneath that metal, next to the boiler, right next to the metal, was 2 or 3 inches of asbestos. These things were coated with asbestos. And so we stripped these engines, cut off all the sheet metal, and then we encountered asbestos around them.
Of course, at that time, nobody was concerned,
and I don't know how much asbestos those men, including myself, I only worked about 2.5-3 years, mm-hmm. but I don't realize how much asbestos those persons working in that facility took into their body. We weren't environmentally conscious nor environmentally correct.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Let me go back and ask you, when you were in the military, where were you stationed?
Most of my time, part of the time I was stationed in the continental United States from Texas to New England. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I got into an area called air traffic. We handled and monitored air traffic, similar to what air controllers do now. Mm-hmm. And I was trained as what is called an air traffic control technician. And
okay, let me stop you there, because where I'm going with this is you were serving in the military during a period of a very segregated society.
Right.
Both in Paducah, mm-hmm. and other places. And I wonder, first off, if you can tell me when you first became aware that you were growing up in a segregated society.
I was always aware of it. I was always aware of it because everything was separate when I grew up. I grew up as a small child in the 30s, as a teenager in the 40s. Separate school, separate but unequal. I later in history learned of the, I believe it was the 1898 decision by the Supreme Court, Plessy v. Ferguson, that established the separate but equal as being acceptable, but in truth, it was separate and very, very unequal. And I was always aware of this, and it was almost inhumane, but we were not as sensitive to it as we became later on, as society began to, these walls began to fall, and we realized some of the things that we had been denied. And actually, when I look back over it, it was a very, very uneven playing field. Very, very severely handicapped young people growing up. I can testify to that now because when I look back and look at the facilities of the segregated schools that I attended, as compared to the schools of, that the white students were able to attend and the privileges that they enjoy, I see how it really hampered the African-American population for years and years to come.
Although you knew that there were separate facilities of all kinds, separate restaurants, probably bus station, waiting rooms, things of that sort.
Waiting rooms. At that time, the railroad was the primary mode of long transportation across a considerable number of miles, and there were segregated waiting rooms even in the railroad station.
But growing up as a little boy in Paducah and a teenager, did you ever try and resist that in any way?
Not as a teenager, because during the period that I grew up, the movement toward integration in terms of public demonstrations, in terms of public attention, had not reached that level.
I'm looking for even smaller instances, and I'll give you an example. Some individuals will tell me that when they were children, even though they knew they weren't supposed to drink out of the white fountain, they would anyway.
Oh, yes, we did those things.
They'd take a seat at the drugstore counter until their mother made them.
Yes, we did. As a youngster, we did those things. Because of our ages, of my age, I didn't look at it as I look at it if I had been an adult. Yes, we do those things, and we would even go into restrooms marked white and until somebody run us out, you know. And yes, we did those things because we were fully aware that something wasn't right.
Okay. When you were in the military and traveling the way you did that give you any insight into the way things might be back in Paducah?
Well, my first experience in integration was in the military. President Harry Truman had issued an executive order. It was either in 48 or 49, desegregating the military by the stroke of a pen. And so when I went into the military in 1950, the military was already very much into the process of desegregating, and by it being the military and under the jurisdiction of the president, it was not a snail's pace process. Some places it might have been some bumps in the road, but they didn't have to go through all this judicial process. The order was signed, that was it, this is what we do. So I went into a desegregated military, still unequal though, still unequal.
And that was a new experience for you?
The desegregation, the living in same quarters with various nationalities, that's when I encountered Hispanics. We lived in the same barracks with Caucasians, Hispanics, first-generation Europeans.
How was that for you?
It was a learning experience, very enlightening learning experience. I first realized then that there's no difference in us except our physical appearance. We bleed the same blood. We're here in the military for the same reason. I looked at myself, and we all have the same characteristics, except we have different ethnic backgrounds. And I sometimes, as a kid, I used to shut my eyes, and I said, if I couldn't see, everybody would be the same. Coping. Yes.
Okay. Now, at some point, I know from your biographical information that you had a long career with the Postal Service.
Yes.
How did that come about?
As I said, was in a segregated society. I worked for the railroad. I enjoyed working for the railroad, but as a young person, I was not aware that this was dead end. This was going to change. I was in my early 20s. Afterwards, I later realized that even what I was doing at the railroad was bringing about a change, because we were going from one system in the railroad to another, and eventually the railroad would not be that huge employer that it once was, nor was there opportunities there for African Americans. It was segregated, even the workplace. When I went to work for the railroad, we reported to work in the same building, but the whites were on one side of the building, a small square building with a wall partition. They were on one side of the building reporting to work, and we were on the other side of the partition. And we'd go out on the same yard and do the same work. Terrible. Terrible. And so what happened, I experienced several layoffs. That's what was what happened when you work for the railroad. For almost any reason, the railroad would have a layoff. For instance, I remember the first layoff, it was because they had a strike in the steel industry. And the railroad experienced an effect from that nationwide steel strike. And so some people working on the railroad were laid off, maybe because of the lack of transporting certain materials or whatever. I don't know the reason. But I know in a 2.5 year period, I experienced about 2-3 layoffs. And I said, I need to get a job.
I'm interested, did the black employees receive more layoffs than the white employees?
When I went to work for the railroad in the department that I worked in, they literally had two rosters of employees. And they were listed on that roster by seniority. But they had one roster that all the blacks were listed on, and another roster that all the whites were listed on. The railroad was very, very segregated because African Americans did not get opportunities for jobs that paid higher levels of pay. For example, the railroad had a lot of craft workers. They had machinists. They had boilermakers. They had blacksmiths. They had pipe fitters, they had locomotive engineers, they had various types. They had a big office in Paducah. That building is still on Kentucky Avenue, around the 1500 block. The only black person in that building was doing the cleaning work, while they had a large office staff there. Some people doing just basic clerical work, but we had no opportunities for any of that. In the craft work, like machinist, boilermaker, blacksmith, pipe fitter, these kinds of jobs, young white males would come to work for the railroad, and they would on many, many occasions, depending upon the need, assigned them as apprentice tradesmen, meaning they were in the process of learning to become a machinist, in the process of learning to become a blacksmith, in the process of learning to become a boilermaker, in the process of learning to become whatever type of skilled trade that required a period of training. And black employees could not and were not assigned to these apprentice positions of apprentice boilermaker, apprentice machinist, apprentice blacksmith, whatever that craft trade, they were not given those assignments. So what happened on the railroad, the most glaring form of inequities, and I believe that our struggle as a people, I would rather focus on the economic than the socials of the struggle, because the white employee, young man, would be assigned to a machinist apprentice. He would ultimately become a journeyman machinist, a journeyman blacksmith, a journeyman boilermaker, and his salary would rise accordingly. Now, what happened? He was able to support his family at a higher standard of living. He was able to send his sons and his daughters to college. The African American never reached that level with the railroad.
Well, so really the only jobs for African Americans were the sleeping car porters.
There were a few. For example, my cousin, who I mentioned, and several others, became what they call locomotive crane operators. So they were able to make a few cents more on the hour. A few of African Americans became locomotive crane operators, but they couldn't become engineers. And so the economics of that struggle is the white employees were able to raise the standard of living for their families, give their children educational opportunities because of the economics of society, and therefore place them in a higher level of achievement and a position to subsequently support their families, and it was passed from one generation to another. So while you often hear and you have heard down through the years, I wasn't part of that. I did not do that. They are absolutely correct when they say that. But they benefited from it. Because John's son was able to go to Paducah Community College, and Joe, whose black son, couldn't go. And when John's son, and John was a machinist at the railroad, when his son finished 2 years and wanted to go to Murray or UK or whatever college, his dad had the money to send him, because his dad drew more money from the railroad because he had a better job that Joe's dad didn't have. And not only did he experience the segregation of on-site society in Paducah in terms of the schools here, but he couldn't even afford to go beyond Paducah because of the economics of society.
I can tell you're a very articulate and very passionate speaker, and I wonder, at what point did you decide to become involved in politics?
Speaking of speaking, I the first college course, I never finished college, but I always, I was always taking college courses somewhere. I was in the military, and I went to school through the Air Force, and took some college courses, and the first course I took was public speaking. Mm-hmm. And I found that I liked this. And I remember this day, and it was 40 some years ago. I did research on the common aspirin.
Aspirin?
Yes, okay. Acetyl salicylic acid. Mm-hmm. And I crafted a speech around the common aspirin. I'll never forget it. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed literature, history, and English, and those type of courses where I could have a dialogue back and forth and get beyond and explore intentions and ideas. I think one of the basic things I think that a good education is, and it's not all in the classroom, is a good basic liberal education that society doesn't focus on too much now. History, literature, English, things like that. We learn how to communicate, which is extremely important.
So from an early day, really, you knew that you enjoyed public speaking.
Well, my grandfather,
issues of the time, did that move you into politics?
50 years before the Voting Rights Act.
Uh-huh.
During the administration of Woodrow Wilson, my grandfather was a landowner. He paid his poll tax and he registered and he voted. And I still have his voter certificate that goes back to the time, I believe, Woodrow Wilson was elected. Mm-hmm. So my parents were, I can remember my grandmother when I was a small child on election day. We didn't have an automobile, but she would get ready and she would be waiting for him to come and get her to go and vote. I always seen voting in my house. Mm-hmm. Go and vote. I'm passionate about it.
And for the record, let me just say that Mr. Coleman has just shared the receipt that his grandfather paid in 1905 for 75 cents.
Oh, this is the one I was going to give you. That's the one. I made a mistake there.
Here we go. The voter's certificate to certify that Abe Coleman is a legal voter and could vote in the 1916 general election. Thank you.
I gave you the wrong one.
It's all right. They're both good. So voting was always important to you. You grew up knowing that that was important. Tell me a little bit, though, there obviously was a poll tax. Were there any other efforts in this area of the state that you had heard about historically that were used to diminish the black vote in any way?
Now, let me be clear. I never experienced this voter certificate dating 1916, 84 years ago. I never experienced this kind of a condition. This was a condition my grandfather experienced and my grandparents back in those days. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, when he voted, you couldn't vote.
Mm-hmm, that's right. It was before women's right to vote.
That's right.
I'm asking you this, Mr. Coleman, because we really have not done much historical research about the black vote in Kentucky.
Well, I think the basic thing that happened back in the early days, I do not recall violence in Kentucky to discourage the African American vote. My experience as a youth was limited to Western Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And I never heard of violence. I never heard of anyone who went to the polls to be turned away if they were registered. Mm-hmm. I never heard of that. What happened was there was no encouragement. All of the elected officials were white. Society was controlled by whites. School systems, everything was separate. And it was not until actually my teen years that I began to experience things that indicated that there was some power in voting. Once in a while, I would hear the black people saying, well, let's try to get some of the streets in the black neighborhoods paved. Let's try to get a street light here or street light there. Let's try to get some of these jobs. And it was not until past 1950 that African Americans got anything other than common labor jobs in city government. Although we were taxpayers. My folks, I say it proudly, my family has been paid tax in the Commonwealth over 100 years, and I got the evidence. I have the evidence. Handwritten tax receipts over 100 years old, but yet we could not experience the fruits of being law-abiding, tax-paying citizens. Trauma was experienced to get African-Americans into higher levels beyond the laboring stage of hauling garbage and digging ditches.
At what point in Paducah do you think that the black community became aware of the need to organize for the vote so that they could accomplish more?
Best I can remember, personal experience would be in the late 40s and starting in the 50s, mm-hmm. And I think really we became focused in the mid 50s when Dr. Martin Luther King began the movement in Montgomery, Alabama. Mm-hmm. My family was always involved, my extended family, it was a gentleman named Curly Brown.
Mm-hmm. Who was the president of the local NAACP. Yeah,
he was president going back into the late, into the 1930s. Mm-hmm. He was the one that filed the lawsuit to break down the barriers at Paducah Junior College at that time. So my family was always, and his son was the first African American student, so my family an extended family was always involved in the progressive move. My cousin W.C. Young, who was an administrative assistant, and I Governor Breathitt really liked W.C. At the time that picture was made at the July Hall of Fame Kentucky Commission on Human Rights ceremonies, I was speaking with the governor, and I told him that I was a cousin of W.C. Young, and his eyes lit up, and I said, he worked for you. And Governor Breathitt said, no, he was my administrative assistant. In other words, he raised the level right then, and I felt good about that. He was Governor Breathitt was a pioneer. He assigned W.C. to go out and recruit minorities, and Governor Breathitt was committed to raising the level of black participation. He was a pioneer. I'll always love him.
So in the 40s and the 50s, and I guess you're saying with the assistance of the local NAACP, there was more of an emphasis on voter registration.
Yeah, there were pioneers in those days, like one of the outstanding pioneers who worked for black voter registration. There were several of them. Ivo Boyd comes to my mind. I don't know whether you've encountered that name or not.
Spell the first name for me.
Actually, his name was Charles Ivo, I-V-O. We always referred to him as Ivo Boyd.
No, I haven't. Yeah.
He was a pioneer in getting black people registered to vote. Mm-hmm. Ivo spent a lot of time in Chicago, Illinois, for better opportunities. Ivo was born just before the turn of the century, somewhere around the early 1890s. And by training, I think Ivo was a mortician. Mm-hmm. He spent a lot of years in Chicago, came back to Paducah around the mid-century period, 1950s, and registered black people to vote, worked in campaigns for various public officials, mm-hmm. even ran for city commissioner. W.C. Young was outstanding. His primary effort was in the field of organized labor. Mm-hmm. Curly Brown, whom you've heard of, mm-hmm.
But I've also been struck that you have had some early being in the 60s here, I believe, African-American elected public officials.
The first one elected, it was in the 60s, the first elected a member of city government. Actually, his first year he was appointed, but he had ran to be a city commissioner's Reverend W.G. Harvey. Mm-hmm. He ran. We put a major effort in that campaign. I believe it was 1967. Mm-hmm. We put a major effort into it.
When you define major for me, what?
Well, there was a good, strong organization. Mm-hmm. The core of the organization was the churches. Mm-hmm. There were volunteers. The effort was not diluted by additional black people running for the same position. We were focused on, let's get Reverend Harvey elected as a city commissioner. Mm-hmm. With all that effort, and we had not begun to attract white voters to our cause, except in minuscule small numbers. There have always been fair-minded white people, and I will never deny that. Always, we across this country, we wouldn't be where we are now if it had not been. But in large numbers, we did not attract white support. And so Reverend Harvey came in number five. He had come in top four. A gentleman named Fellers passed away. He was elected to be a commissioner, and he passed away before the first of the year. This was in 67. So they were going to have to appoint someone to serve that first year until the next November to have a special election. Mm-hmm. Robert C. Cherry was mayor. Again, the black community came together and they said, look, Reverend Harvey was number five. He was the next person that would have been elected. If there's any logic and any sound reasoning here, he will be the person appointed. And there was different discussions. There was even suggested that other people who had not sought the office, who had not participated in the election, other black Americans, African Americans, names were suggested. Now, these people didn't say, I want it. Someone else would suggest their name. It was like creating confusion. Mm-hmm. And these people would step forward and say, no, I don't want that. If anybody is appointed, and these are black people speaking. If anybody is appointed, we are solidly behind Reverend Harvey. And he was appointed. The next November, they had a special election. And no white candidates would run, except one. And there were plenty of them, always have been, that normally would have ran in a special election. But they said, no. We're not going to run.
Why do you think that was? Do you think they knew they couldn't win?
No. I think it was because that there was enough influential people who had come together and said, wait a minute, we need some African-American presence. And we're not going to get around this process by running against Harvey in this special election. Mm-hmm. And this one gentleman, he was I think ex-police officer, might have been a police officer. He was going to run anyway. But what happened is the white community supported Reverend Harvey. Mm-hmm. So he was appointed his first year. He won in that special election in the following November. And he subsequently served for four more years, served a total of 6 years. 1973 was his last year.
And then in 1974, you... Were
I yes, I was elected. I was elected in 73.
Mm-hmm. And you've been a city commissioner from 1973 to the present without interruption.
Had two interruptions.
Okay. I see you're running again.
Obviously.
In November.
I won my first election. Reverend Harvey elected not to run for re-election in 73. I ran. And fortunately, I won. And I served 74 and 75. And what happened I had an interruption that right after that first term. In 1975, we began to experience a large number of complaints filed with the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights alleging police brutality here in the city of Paducah, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And they reached a volume where the Commission on Human Rights decided to send down an investigator. And then I should never forget the gentleman. His name was Bill Holliday. He was out of Louisville. He subsequently became a lawyer, I believe Bill did. But I was in my second year of my first term. And I blended a career at the Postal Service. I never did tell you why I went to the Postal Service.
That's okay.
We'll come back to that maybe. I was working for the Postal Service. And the first thing I did before I ran, I'd been told, no, you work for the federal government. You can't run. And I'm a little stubborn.
And we had the Hatch Act, didn't we?
Yeah, the Hatch Act. But see, people were interpreting the Hatch Act wrongly. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask locally if I could run. I wrote a letter to the Postmaster General. Mm-hmm. And he had his legal staff to write me back. And they said, yes, if it is nonpartisan, you can run. Mm-hmm. They would have told me here, no. Mm-hmm. And I had the documentation that I could run. And so I filed, and I was successful, and I won. Now, to 1975, my second year, I was at home one evening, and the doorbell rang. I went to the door, and stood a gentleman with a briefcase, an ID, official ID. Mr. Coleman, yes. He says, my name is Bill Holliday. I'm an investigator with the State Commission on Human Rights. May we speak? Yes, sir. Come on in. He said, Mr. Coleman said, the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights have received numerous complaints alleging police brutality here in Paducah, Kentucky. It's reached a level of concern where I've been assigned to investigate. He said, I have a list of names and addresses here. I don't know anything about your city. I need to find these people. I need to talk to them. And what I need is someone as a guide to take me to these various people. And I have been told that you would do that for me.
Did you not have a local commission on human rights at that time?
Yes.
But they elected not to work.
Well, we only had a commission. We did not have an office.
I see.
We did not have a full-time director.
Right.
We just had a structured commission.
Right, okay.
And I think they were passing this on to Louisville because they didn't have any
right.
other means.
Okay.
So I said, yes, I'll do that, after we talked. And so I began the process by me working in the evenings. I would come home, shower and change clothes, shower and get ready, and we would go finding, I would have the clipboard, and I'd say, okay, this is John Doe. Yeah, I know where he lives, I know. And we would go. Well, it doesn't take long before somebody says, something's going to be done. There was an investigator here, and Commissioner Coleman brought him to my house. Well, the word leaked to the police department here. Coleman has got an investigation going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they launched a smear campaign on me.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost that election by less than 100 votes. I would have won it, but the timing was such I could not recover. The campaign was launched less than a week before the election. And that was my first term in office. I had not established full credibility. And it turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened.
For you to lose the election?
Yes.
Why do you say that?
That was my first term.
Mm-hmm.
I set out a term. I became so discouraged in the process of that smear campaign that I started to abandon politics completely. I said, if this is what politics is all about, I don't want any parts of it. But I had some good friends, and I go back to the scripture when Job was experiencing his difficulty. I was going through a Job experience, except my friends came to me and they said, you're not going to quit. You're not going to quit. Said, you're going to gird up your loins,
mm-hmm.
you're going to hold your head up, you're going to work, You're going to keep your head high and you're going to fight.
I did.
I lost, but I felt good. But the reason I said it was the best thing that happened to me, I was out for a 2-year interval. I came back, and for 2 successive elections, I ran number 1 out of the whole field of candidates. I was mayor pro tem. And the only other interval I had in 1991, I elected to run for mayor, and I lost that election. So I, beginning in 1974 to the day, I had 2 intervals. Other than that, I'm on my 23rd year.
Think you'll be reelected in the fall?
I never take anything for granted. I learned that early in life. I'll be out there working hard. I hope the people will judge me by my record, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and by my ability, and by my preparation, and by my determination.
Mr. Coleman, what do you consider to be your most significant contributions as a member of the commission all these years?
I wished I had known this kind of question was coming, because there's so many things. When I came into office, we have numerous boards and commissions of volunteer people who influence and impact the quality of life in Paducah. Everything from the library board, we have a municipal owned waterworks board, we have a municipal owned electric utility board, we have a planning and zoning commission, we have a human rights commission, we have all kinds of boards and commissions. And at the time I came into office, one of the things that black African Americans were not part of are some of these key boards that influence the quality of life. I'll never forget it. There are always some good people. At that time, the mayor was a lady named Alice Dolly McNutt. She was affectionately known as Dolly McNutt. My very first meeting or two, Mayor McNutt says, Robert says, man, I need to talk with you, man. We were preparing for a meeting. I said, sure, Mayor. And we went into her office. She said, have a seat. Shut the door. And she handed me a legal pad with several pages. And I looked down, and it had the names of various boards and commissions and the names of persons serving on these boards and their 10-year service. She said, Robert, said, those are boards and commissions appointed by the mayor. Said, that copy is yours. Said, now the mayor has the right to make these appointments, and they are certified by the city commission. Said, now, I want to be fair. Said, you study those. And he said, when term expiration evolves on some of these appointments, and you have a recommendation, don't hesitate to let me know, and I will give it consideration. I said, thank you, Mayor. Well, I looked at them, and those boards that we did not have an African-American presence, especially some of the key boards, I start focusing on those. And one of those boards was the electric plant board. See, we have a municipal-owned electric utility distribution system. We don't generate electricity, we distribute it. It's called the electric plant board. And so my campaign manager at that time was the business manager of the West Kentucky Technical School. Mm-hmm. And he was well qualified. I knew his background. We were good friends.
Can you tell me his name?
Kinkle Anderson.
Okay.
So I.
Kinkle?
K-I-N-K-L-E. Very odd name. I've never seen it before in my life.
Thank you.
And I approached him. I said, would you consider serving on the electric plant board? He said, are you kidding? I said, no. I said, I've talked to the mayor, and I said, if you will consider serving, I will recommend you. He said, I'd be delighted. And so I was always a stickler for, in some instances, formality. So I drafted a letter to Mayor McNutt recommending Kinkle. for clarity, I recommended Mr. Anderson. And she received the letter, and shortly after she received the letter, she called me to her office. And she said, Robert, said, I received your letter. She says, I know Mr. Anderson, said, he's an ably qualified person for this board. And she says, I remember what I told you. She says, but I have a problem, Robert. And I said, what is that, Mayor? She said, I had promised this appointment to Mr. John Doe. That wasn't his name. Said, but I remember what I told you. She said, now, if you insist, I will appoint Mr. Anderson instead of Mr. Doe. Said, but if you will allow me to fulfill my prior commitment, said, the very next appointment to this board, I'll appoint Mr. Anderson. I said, Mayor, go ahead and appoint the person you've promised. We had a good working relationship in that respect. The very next appointment, that was the first African-American presence on this board. At the present time, not only am I city commissioner of this same board, I'm secretary treasurer, a member and secretary treasurer on this elected plan board. But subsequently, I was able to get African-American presence on all of these key boards. Then,
so in addition to helping to secure African-American appointments to boards and commissions, I understand that you were also instrumental in increasing jobs.
That's what I'm getting ready. I increased the first personnel director for the city of Paducah, African-American personnel director. I was instrumental in this. The first full-time executive director and office staff and establishment of a human rights commission full-time, I was instrumental in doing that. The first African-American police chief, I was instrumental in that. The first African-American fire chief, I was instrumental in that. The first African-American director of solid waste, I was instrumental in that. And it goes on and on. Paducah has had a level of participation in high-level appointments unparalleled to other cities of its size in Kentucky, even other cities, period. And I was right in the middle of all of these things.
I have one final question to ask you, and that is, where would you like to go from here?
I'm a senior citizen. I've often said that I'm winding down, but sometimes in my heart I don't think I'll wind down. It seems like I'll probably continue, and while I'm a senior citizen, I'll probably run for office again after this time. I haven't said that before. But I put it in this context. As long as I can be effective, as long as I maintain my integrity, as long as I conduct myself in a way that no one can tell me because they have certain controls of what to do, I will be in the arena. Mm-hmm. I just have to be there, seemingly, inside of me.
Right. I told you earlier that I would come back and ask you how you became a member of the Kentucky Bar Association as a non-lawyer.
As a non-lawyer.
That has to be pretty unusual.
It was. The first inkling of this occurred in 1998. I'm a member of a church down the street, two blocks from here. It was organized 145 years ago.
In the name of the church?
Washington Street Missionary Baptist Church. At the time it was organized, 145 years ago, down at 721 Washington, two blocks down the street, that was the edge of town. It was 10 years prior to the end of slavery. Mm-hmm. It's considered a downtown church, along with four other churches, all happen to be white. It's the Episcopal Church, Grace Episcopal, on Broadway. Broadway United Methodist Church, which is the oldest institution in Paducah. St. Francis de Sales Catholic Church, and the first.
You were telling me when my tape cut off about the early churches and how you became involved with the bar.
We have a participation program where these five churches come together for a week of services leading up to Easter, 5 days. And they have a noonday service. And each day, a different church is in charge of that noonday service. And in 1998, my minister, when it came the day for Washington Street's participation, my minister was going to be out of the city. And so I was asked to deliver the message. I'm not a minister. I'm a deacon, but I'm not a minister. And so I said, well, this is new. But I says, as a layperson, I'll give it my best. And the services were being held at 7th and Jefferson at the First Presbyterian Church. And so I was the speaker for the noonday services during Easter week, leading up to Easter. And we were having lunch following that service. We always had lunch each day following the service, because people came from work during the noon hour, participated in the service, and went back to work. We fed them lunch. And sitting across from me at the lunch period following the service was one of the justices of the Kentucky Supreme Court, whom I happen to know, and he's from Paducah, Justice Graves. And he congratulated me. He said, Robert, you did a fine job today. I said, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Justice, thank you. He said, I got something I want you to consider. I said, well, what is that? He said, I'd like to recommend you for the Bar Association Public Inquiry Commission. And I said, but what's that? And he said, well, we have decided to put four non-lawyers on the Bar Association Inquiry Commission, and they handle complaints of lawyer discipline. And said, there are four people statewide, one from Eastern Kentucky, one from Northern Kentucky, one from the central areas, one from Western Kentucky. Only four. Says, and I want to recommend you as the person from Western Kentucky to serve. And within a few seconds, I said, this is a grand opportunity. And I said, well, if I'm accepted, Mr. Justice, I'd be delighted. And I got a letter back from Chief Justice Lambert, April, for lawyer discipline.
And we have a copy.
And I gave you a copy.
Right, that we'll put in the record.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. And I'm one of four non-lawyers, and I've served for over a year. And it's been a challenge. It's been a new experience. And as a matter of fact, we convene bimonthly at the Bar Center in Frankfurt. And it's been a wonderful opportunity and challenge. And it's good to, and the lawyers, the Bar Association have complimented the laypersons because of our input and our, that's not attached to all those legal terms and other opinions that lawyers seem to like to talk in.
Well, thank you for sharing with me today.